action regarding non-service-connected disability retirement for deceased member John Mazzetti. Gail, are you taking up this item?
I'll take it.
Okay. Got a cool team.
Brought in the heavy guns today.
We did.
And he did a good report.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay. This item was brought before the board at their January 9th, 2019 meeting. The board had some questions and requested additional information regarding this item. Background information to refresh the case. John Mazzetti was an active Tier 3 member with over 23 years of SSERA retirement service. Credit, he passed away on March 25th, 2017 from cardiopulmonary arrest. Prior to his passing, SSERA received an active death form, the Form 104, from Mr. Mazzetti. Per our process and procedures, Mr. Mazzetti's medical records were provided to the board's medical advisor, and you do have a copy of his report in your packet, to determine if he was totally disabled from any employment prior to his passing. The medical advisor concluded that prior to his passing, Mr. Mazzetti was totally disabled from any employment, and he met the requirements of a permanent disability for a Tier 3 member on a non-service-connected disability basis. The recommendations that were posed to the board were to find that John Mazzetti was permanently unable to engage in any substantial gainful employment and grant a non-service-connected retirement to him effective March 25th, 2017. And secondly, grant his beneficiary benefits to under Government Code Section 31762, which is optional settlement 2.
Did you have something to add, Harvey?
I'm happy to add some more gloss to this, but it's up to the board if there were questions that you wanted to specifically address. I'd like to address with you the law and the policy behind it, if that would be of help.
I think so.
Okay, for the record, Harvey Lederman, Reed Smith, Fiduciary Counsel. We've been wrestling with this issue, as you know, for at least the last decade, as far as I've been involved with SSERA and other systems as well. It's interesting. We recently had the appellate court ruling in the Wilmot case. Court of Appeals in Wilmot described our law, the 37 Act, the SERL, as a statute of almost fiendish complexity. That's what we're dealing with in a lot of these issues. The death and disability and survivor benefit provisions of our law are fiendishly complex. And you know, we try to discern a not only what the words mean, what they say, but a lot of times we have to fill in the blanks and how they overlap with each other. The policy in our law is favorable towards surviving spouses of members. The law rather specifically favors surviving spouses' ability to choose benefits where they might otherwise be left with the unmodified benefit. The unmodified benefit is 100% to the member during life, and then nothing to the surviving spouse. So to avoid the consequence of that, the law allows surviving spouses to have a choice even after the member passes away. And so we don't really have a lot of judicial guidance on how to interpret these particular sections together. this act of death and disability has been one of those things that the legislature has never specifically dealt with. However, we do have a very strong on-point Supreme Court decision that goes back about 50 years in a very similar situation under the judge's retirement plan, which is administered by CalPERS. And I cited that case to you and described it in my memorandum to you, the Gorman case. And it rather endorses the process that CSERA has been using for years in terms of the ability to pre-designate a choice of an optional settlement that springs into being in the event the member is in the event that the timing is such that there is no time to have the luxury of signing a form and carrying it over or electronically transmitting it to CSERA before the member passes away. So I want to give you, try to put it in a little bit of context. I want to give you three examples that I've tried to wrestle with to come up with a determination as to whether we could treat these people differently and how we might do that under the law. So I'll try to keep the variables down and give you three examples. Let's suppose in the first example that a member has a massive heart attack, goes to the hospital, is told that his heart is weak, likely has 6 months to live. He's bedridden, obviously can't go back to work. During that 6 months, the member spouse get their affairs in order. The member files for disability benefit and files an option to election. That is 100% continuance to a spouse. After filing that, at the end of 6 months, a member dies. That's our first scenario. Second scenario, member has a massive heart attack, is taken to the hospital, is recuperating in the hospital for a couple of days. The prognosis is unknown. The spouse heads up, brings over to the hospital, gets the member to sign a disability application and an option to settlement, files it with CSERA, and then the member dies. That's our second scenario. The third scenario is our member has a massive heart attack, is taken to the hospital, dies shortly thereafter, but before that, in anticipation of events that might happen with such rapidity, the member had filed with CSERA, when they went into employment, the optional choice of disability and option two. So those are our three scenarios. And the question that I'm trying to wrestle with on your behalf is, should we treat those members differently? And if so, on what basis, either legal or policy matter, why does it matter the sequence of filing? We know that the optional settlement can be elected at any time up to retirement, and a disability can be filed even after retirement. So we have three scenarios where the only difference is the order in which certain forms are filed and the timing of the filing of those forms relative to the member's death.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, please.
Because in your scenarios, what I don't see being taken into account is that the member feels well enough to go back to work. And in fact, the member is at work and working, dies suddenly, and we still deem the disability. And that's what I'm grappling with. And I really appreciate all of your memos, your early one that your law firm did when we were initially adopting this, and your more recent one. But for me, I find it very troubling that someone is at work. So are they disabled? Well, they're actually at work.
Okay.
They die. They're found dead. But we're saying there must have been some nanosecond where they were still alive, and that's when they were disabled, because at that moment they were no longer working because they were, you know, but we don't know because no one was with them.
Incapable.
And so then you put in your memo, if it was an instant death, a shot to the heart, shot to the brain, well, isn't there a nanosecond of life before they completely, you know, their spirit or whatever happens to them disappears? You know, so to me, I'm just not there yet.
Yep.
Because of this very unique circumstance. And I appreciate all of this giving us this perspective of why we're doing it and the whole disability. But what I find most troubling in this circumstance is the employee was not deemed, yes, he had a heart condition that manifested itself previously, but he was at work, he was working, found dead. So at what point did that disability start to trigger this? So, and I get, you know, it's sort of a philosophical thing. This is very helpful, and if the rest of the board goes that way, you know, I'm not going to be offended. This is just, for me, I'm just not there.
I truly appreciate that, and that's why we have been wrestling with this for so long. And ultimately, you know, the original question that I was asked 9 years ago, and that formed the basis of the memorandum, was whether the board was acting lawfully in continuing mm-hmm. this practice. And it was, as you can see from what we wrote then, it was our belief that that was a reasonable interpretation sure. of the statute. In the most recent memorandum, which I did for you, the question was, what are the courts likely to do in this situation? On top of, you know, is it reasonable under the law to do it, of course. And so I didn't change our view of that. Mm-hmm. But the question is, what are the courts likely to do if you were to deny and this were to be challenged? And based on that Supreme Court precedent, I think it's fairly likely which way the courts might go. We have a recent example at SACERA of a spousal, you know, the interpretation of a court of appeals on a spousal rights case involving this board. And you may remember which way the court went on that, rather favorable to the spouse in that situation. There is, and I tried to give us a bit of a standard in you know, hearkening back to disability law, where we talk about, is there a real and measurable disability where someone is permanently incapacitated as a result of it? And so I tried to hearken to the concept of a real and measurable, a discernible period of time where a member is disabled and can no longer do their job, and death. And Lord knows whether, you know, that goes from a day, a week, a month, or a nanosecond. I would think in the scheme of things that a nanosecond is probably insufficient to,
yeah, but,
on
you know,
which to pin a disability.
On that
but
point,
I can't
though, Harvey,
say that.
But I mean, I have to agree with Candace on this. I can't come up with a scenario where we aren't going to grant the benefit. Decedent found in the rubble, earthquake, disaster. Opinion after the fact, well, it's a lot of rubble, but we're fairly certain he lived perhaps for a few minutes or a few seconds. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be lurid. I mean, you could go through countless examples of that. And here, and I mean, no disrespect to the family. I don't know if anybody's here or they listen to these things, but a person is found deceased. We go to a doctor to have him opine who does it solely on the records of others. This stuff would be, in my judgment, likely inadmissible at trial. Makes a determination that
he must have lived for at least a few seconds or a minute or two. He doesn't really know. Dr. Blink, with all respect, doesn't really know, right? He's speculating.
And there's no... And
he's creating a record.
There's no forensic evidence. You know, it wasn't like, and we saw him crawling, you know, you could see him crawling toward the door.
Or right, there was no witness. You're
pushing,
right.
Reaching for his phone. I mean, so again, it's just, this is a very generous benefit. I'm fairly new in the scheme of things to this, but this is just one of those things where, from the layperson, looking at this thing, you're giving someone a disability benefit when they die instantly and they're disabled because they're dead, because that's essentially, you know, the reaction. They're disabled because they can no longer work because they're dead. And then you have to say, well, no, but they, you know, we think they probably live 2 seconds. So they're not, you know, they were disabled for those 2 seconds. It just sort of flies by from a common sense reading of the law, of the intent of this. So that's where my problem is. I don't want to belabor this because I think I'm probably in the minority on this, and this is very helpful. There are other situations where I can see where it would make more sense, where there's a greater lapse of time. Mm-hmm. My concern is in this specific instance, I just don't feel that the doctor provided in his report sufficient evidence to bolster his opinion that the person lived for any length of time. So
would you be okay if he had lived long enough to be found, and then as they're taking him to the hospital, they said, hey, sign this form?
Yep. I even if he had already signed the form. It, for me, it's just in this instance where there is no evidence to support the doctor's opinion that the person was disabled for any period of time.
So to me, first of all, I don't like the word we're giving them something. This member paid for this. This is built into, the actuaries know about this. I pay for it, you pay for it, Will pays for it, David pays for it. Everyone in this room pays for it. We're not giving them anything. He was unfortunate that he passed away, and now his spouse gets to collect on what he paid for. This case is... But for it being at work, before this board on September 13th, 2017, we had brought before us the case of Paul Crouch, an active member who died of a massive heart attack while in his hotel room in Hawaii. His family walked in and found him. The vote for that one was 9-0 with the exception of Rusty, every voting member of this board currently voted for that with little to no discussion. If we don't grant this, we're doing exactly what Harvey said. We're picking winners and losers based on just microscopic seconds of time. My wife and daughter rolled up on a car accident last Thursday. It was a horrible car. It happened right in front of him. It was a horrific accident. My daughter ran to the driver. She was lucid at the time. So if she was a member of CICERA, if she had, in that moment of lucidity, signed something, no matter what happens afterwards, if she happens to pass, which fortunately I've been in contact with the family, that woman has since been in a coma since that time. I don't know if it's drug induced or not. It's a stranger, and I'm not getting that involved. But so we're saying, boy, you were fortunate. You had that small moment of lucidity, but if you had slipped into a coma or, you know, bled out right then and there, where are we drawing the line? This is morbid to me. This is something that's paid for. It's been routine. We've had counsel opine on it. I think to even further this anymore is very off-putting to me. And I'm sorry. I say that with all due respect. I know that, you know, you take your role very seriously and what have you. And members who didn't vote for it last week, I have the utmost respect for. But in this case, it just seems so wrong.
But the doctor.
So I find it unlikely that someone having a heart attack is going to die in a nanosecond. Usually it takes minutes, at least. In this case, where it's unwitnessed, someone gets a gunshot to the head, witnessed, we know that's it. In this situation where it was unwitnessed, I think you have to give the benefit of the doubt to the individual. I mean, assuming that it will take minutes for someone to die during an MI. Why would we assume the opposite? And why would we go in that other direction that, well, because it wasn't witnessed and this person is not deserving of this benefit. But is there, practically speaking, is that something that you would consider? Is like, do you give the individual the benefit of the doubt and say, well, okay, more than likely this is at least something that's going to take a couple of minutes to do?
You know, I think this is a situation where we could all agree that reasonable minds can differ. I think every one of us would say, I feel strongly about my view of this, but I think, you know, I recognize that other people could reasonably come to a different conclusion. In that situation, we're generally instructed under the law relating to the pension benefits that the ties go to the member, that we are to interpret the law favorably to the member, so long as it's consistent with the law and reasonable under the circumstances. That's why, that's a terrible, I keep saying this every once in a while, it's why you get paid the big bucks, right? You're supposed to exercise collective judgment. We don't have a single trustee for this system. We have 9 people voting, all with different ideas. In this situation, all with very reasonable ideas about where to draw the line, and that's really what we're talking about, is trying to draw a discernible line here. Because if this person had been witnessed, and had done those things, like tried to, you know, or had lived for a day, some people would come to a different conclusion simply because of that factor. So it's perfectly understandable. But the law is written, the policy is written to favor the member where it's reasonable to interpret the law either way. And the other thing that I'll remind you is just a matter of practicality. If it's reasonable for this board to come to a conclusion, I can defend the exercise of that discretion and judgment in court without any problem. I can defend either position. And we've had that every once in a while, where reasonable people can differ and we can look at the ridiculously complex law that we have and go either way, and both are defensible. Part of the situation here is to say, which way are the courts likely to go? Because if you go down a certain route with a decision and the decision is challenged, we're going to have a costly and possibly adverse ruling based upon an estimation. Now, you know, courts differ, but recognizing, as I do, not only who our superior court is here, but more importantly, who sits on and what are the decisions that are coming out of our Court of Appeals in the First District that sits in San Francisco, and what experience do we have with that court, I think it would be prudent for the board to grant this, but I could defend a decision either way. And you'll have to make a collective judgment on that. It's reasonable for you to come to either conclusion.
What's the consequence of denying? What's the consequence to the surviving spouse?
60%?
No.
She's not a safety member.
She would have an election. She could elect that. The default death benefit would be a lump sum payment. And surviving spouses and minor children can make an election instead of that to receive a 60% continuance.
Okay, so there's two. Can I
speak? So they could get an allowance for life. The spouse could get an allowance for life, but it would be a lower amount.
So in 60%. Terms of the statute that requires actuarial equivalence?
Yes.
I didn't see it in 31762. I saw it elsewhere in prior sections, but I didn't see it referenced in 31762. And my question is that a determination that we have to make, or is it presumed to exist?
The actuarial equivalence is among the optional settlements relative to the unmodified option, the default option. So the stream of payments actuarially through the various optional settlements, optional settlement two, there's a three, there's a four, where you can pick a beneficiary. All of those, the actuary will then calculate. They'll take the unmodified benefit, no options selected, and figure out what the present value of that is. And then they'll measure it against the selection of some other option, and those have to come out the same present value. That's what the actuarial equivalence is. It's not actuarially equivalent to the default death benefit. The default death benefit is a combination of two things. One is the refund of contributions from the member plus 1/12 of the member's salary times the number of years the member worked, credited service years. I don't know what it is in this situation. I don't have that data. But that's what the death benefit is. It's a lump sum payment equal to the accumulated contributions in the member's account and this fraction times the number of years they have credited service. So for this particular individual, Tim, maybe you know how many years of service.
He, I believe, had about 23 years of service, but the salary that Harvey mentioned is limited to 50%. So it would be a maximum of six months of salary.
That's right.
Yeah, I was just reacting to the sentence in the staff report that says the optional settlement allowances is actuarially equivalent in value to the total benefits payable to the member and the member survivors over their lifetime and portion of the total benefit. It's that sentence that would give the appearance to me that as part of this option two, there's a determination made that the selection is actuarially equivalent. I was led to think that.
Yeah,
I don't think that's what it says, though.
The question is equivalent to what, and the to what it would be is the 100% unmodified to the member. The unmodified is 100% to the member and zero to the surviving spouse. So, and they calculate that not based on the actual fact that the member died, but they would say, at that point, how old was a member, what was their expected lifetime, and then that would be the 100% benefit to which all other options would have to be actuarially equivalent.
Yeah, I was just, you know, you could think through a lot of scenarios where you have, a 62-year-old decedent and the spouse is 44.
Right.
And you look at the actuarial tables and the spouse is going to live to 84,
right.
87,
yeah.
And the decedent might have only lived another 20 years, if I believe the tables, right?
Right.
I was trying to figure out, is this rough justice? Do you actually try to equivalate that?
Well, the actuary does that, you know, and every one of these optional settlements, when they come into being, they have to be approved by this board, and there's a letter from Siegel that says here's how much it's supposed to be present value, and this is the actuarial equivalent. You get that every single time. I don't know what it is in this situation. It's almost sounding to me like it's a difference between 100% continuance and a 60% continuance to the surviving spouse. That's what we're talking about is the difference here.
Jerry, you've waited patiently.
Thank you. I have two points I want to make. I don't know if anybody has ever seen somebody die of a heart attack, but I have. And I can vouch for the heart attack hits and the person feels the pain and they may stand up, they may slump in their seat, they may do whatever. Mine was witnessed in a church and the man stood up, grabbed his heart, and stood there, and you knew exactly what was happening. And then he keeled over on the side, and paramedics were called. So there was a point there when he felt the pain that I knew there wasn't anything he could do if he had to. So he was disabled in my mind. And that's how I pictured a heart attack, which this gentleman had. So whether or not it was exactly the same circumstances, I can't answer. But my experience with heart attack is that there is a disability section before you hit the ground. That was the first point I want to make. The second part is, yeah, we are 9 different people on this board. And that's why we are here. A lot of what Harvey said is true. We all have different opinions. And we all have to voice our opinions, and we all have to act on them in support of the system. For me, the system was created for the beneficiaries of the system. And if we have a procedure that benefits the beneficiary, then I think we should use that procedure to the beneficiary's benefit. And in cases like this, I feel like the person should be awarded the disability and granted it by this board. I wasn't aware that a short while ago we voted 9-0 on a very similar case, and now we're questioning. But again, that's because we're 9 different personalities and we have that right, and we should exercise that right. So for me, it's plain that this surviving member, the beneficiary, should get the disability retirement. So I'm going to move that we grant John Mazzotti's beneficiary the disability retirement.
So is your motion that find that he was permanently disabled and then grant the benefit?
Correct.
Okay. There's a motion on the floor. David seconded.
Can I have a question of Harvey?
Sure, and then Will, and then
Will,
David.
Do you want to go
no,
first?
No, go ahead.
Harvey, I'm just curious. Other CERL agencies, you know, I'm looking at the final paragraph. Time interval should be real and measurable. Has any other agency come up with a definition of what constitutes real and measurable?
Not in this context.
Not in this context.
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, I was just curious. That's another thing that... Yeah. It disturbs me about the whole thing.
Honestly, that was my attempting to answer the question that I was told was posed by the board at the last meeting. How do we know?
Okay.
Okay, and so Will, David, Rusty, then Scott.
Go. Cool. Good morning. I have a bunch, so try to hold. If you have any questions or want to rebut anything that I say, please hold it till the end. So I listened to this.
Beat this time limit.
But it won't take that long, Dre. I'll get you out of here.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
No, I have a bunch of notes.
I mean, I know it's something that's going to be discussed, and so more than fine.
So I listened to the case. I listened to the discussion at the last in the January meeting, and I appreciate the question, the philosophical question on timing. Like, I get that, right, in terms of death, but this isn't a question of timing. That's not what we're trying to answer. This is a question about John Mazzetti. So, whether or not we grant him, what we've set up a precedent for, including we have memorandums from legal counsel, our fiduciary counsel is saying, is it legal? They believe so. We have a form that we provide the members of our retirement system. We likely, I don't have this for sure, likely staff has recommended this to as options for our members as well, and we have a web form that clearly has a web page. Actually, it has clearly this defined as an option. I have actually, when I first came on this board, I actually put this out as an option to Confire members, just saying, hey, this is something that's available to you as an employee. And so how long have we offered this? Well, we've offered this for, in one of the memorandums, at least 2 decades. I don't know when we actually started launching the forums and all those types of things on the website, but there's clearly a precedent of granting this, offering this, recommending it by this board to our members, including the most recent case that you brought up, which was a 9-0 vote in favor of a 2017 case for this exact thing. They weren't even found you know, at work. So in terms of the timing thing, or whether or not this is a benefit, if you want to call it a death benefit, if you want to call it an option, if you want, whatever you want to call it, that we shouldn't be discussing that right now. The agenda is John Mazzetti, and are we going to grant it to him? If you want to bring this up as a further thing where we have splitting hairs on timing and philosophy, and my experience as a medical professional and Dr. McDonald's, when you have a heart attack, it's not sudden unless somebody rips your heart out of your chest. It's every single time, we're always on the question, whenever I'm treating somebody, there's a question of whether or not we're going to bring them back. There's a question on whether or not they're breathing up by themselves. There's a question on how much tissue death is on the, you know, on the cardiac cells of the heart. Can it still, does it still have, you know, fractional? So there's a whole bunch, there's a whole bunch of things on the timing. That's not the question today. The question is John Mazzetti. And in terms of this being an unfunded liability, this is number one, you know, to what your question was, Scott, I can't answer that on the actuarial thing. But what I do know is we have actuarial experience of this over the last 20 years probably, to say, hey, this is something that members are going for, and they, and it, it follows their table. And that, you know, the loser in this whole thing is the gentleman that died, John Mazzetti. And I'm a little bit disappointed that this board right now is bringing this up on John Mazzetti. I understand, I appreciate the splitting of hairs on the timing and stuff, but this is John Mazzetti. This is something, are we going to give this to John Mazzetti? That's the question. We have a doctor's opinion that says, yes, he was disabled. Dr. McDonald, myself, with our experience, I don't, I'm not going to speak for Dr. McDonald. My experience is people are disabled before they die in a cardiac event every single time, unless you rip their heart out of their chest. So now we also have something presented before this board of a fire chief making a presentation of questioning the ethics of this board. Okay? And on this item, on the John Mazzetti item right now, we're planning on what was what came up, and there was a split vote last month at the last item of trying to take action on this, is we're basically presenting all this to the member, and then at the last second, even after the member has died, he has the he's signed this optional document, and we're going to say, oh, we're not, maybe we're not going to give it to him. Let me bring something up. So Dr. McDonald brought up today and also at the last session, if there's a question to the member, should we grant the benefit to the member? We're not doing anything, in my view, unethical. If we do grant this, I think we're following this precedent we have. It is legal, you know, and the courts, I can tell you the courts, I don't want to go through another legal case and bring something to the courts. I don't think that anybody in the right mind of a jury or a judge with this huge precedent that we have with John Mazzetti, I just think that they would definitively rule in favor of the survivor in this case. That's my expectation. But let me bring some stuff up here. So preamble, I believe, of the California Constitution. Preamble, I believe, of one of our policies that references the California Constitution. Each member of CICERA's board shall discharge his or her duties with respect to the system solely in the interest of and for the exclusive purposes of providing benefits to participants and their beneficiaries, minimizing employer contributions thereto, and defraying reasonable expenses of administering the system with the duty to participants and beneficiaries, with the duty to the participants and beneficiaries taking precedence over any other duty. And also, we have our Code of Fiduciary Conduct and Ethics, item number 3, which was revised in July of 2003. In those situations where their law is not clear, the best interest of the fund beneficiaries must be served. Conscience is critical. Good ends never justify an unethical means. And I just, I have to say, I don't want to remind the board that I appreciate the philosophical philosophical questions on timing of death. I get that. And this benefit, you know, with the California, with Searle and the California Constitution, I appreciate the question there. That's not the question before us. The question before us right now is we have 20 years of precedence of approving these with 9-0 votes probably throughout the history of ever offering this, and we have John Mazzetti before us right now who has the expectation of everything we've delivered before him that we would approve this. So I ask this board today, when you're making a decision, it's not about John Mazzetti. If we want to bring this up as a future action item where we get education additionally on fiduciary counsel on you know, the timing of things and philosophy of death and all that stuff, that's fine. But let's approve this today with a 9-0 unanimous vote, and let's set the precedent. And if you want to bring this up at future meetings, that's fine. But to the fire chief's point, when he brought this up, this board is, you know, he was making mention of unethical. I say if we turn this down right now, we are unethical.
Thank you. Well, David?
So forensically, this was not a coroner's case, as far as I understand it.
Nope.
And in signing many death certificates over the years associated with cardiac arrest, even when I've had patients who have died at home and I get a call from the coroner saying that there's no evidence of foul play or anything, they just want me to sign off on the death certificate. I'm saying this in context to why our medical advisor said what he has said. That you estimate the amount of time death due to this, other complicating factors, and what were the timelines involved. That's on the death certificate. Never once have I said on a death certificate that a patient has died instantaneously from a heart attack. It's always been minutes, if not longer. That is common practice. You see people do that all the time. There was nothing else that our medical advisor had to work on because there was no autopsy, as far as I understand. This was not a coroner's case. There was no forensic investigation. I could only say the same thing, that this person had at least minutes before he died. I understand your concern, and because we don't know. There's information that we don't know. But it seems like it's really a technicality. And common understanding and common practice, and our past practice, would be to give him the benefit of the doubt, and that it took at least several minutes for him to pass away, during which time he was disabled. And we should grant this.
David, I have a question for you. So in signing death certificates, have there been instances outside of a heart attack such as this one where you have said it has, you know, in certain cases there's been instantaneous death?
No, I'm...
Like someone snaps their neck or, I mean, have there been instances that you've signed off on like that?
Well, even if someone has a gunshot to the head, perhaps, but, I mean, even if someone gets a gunshot to the heart, depending on how much of the heart is damaged, I mean, it's still, there's still some time. It's very rare that someone will die instantaneously.
Have you seen it happen?
I have never seen someone get shot in the head, thank God. In my experience in the hospital and in the medical field and out in the field with accidents and so forth, I have not witnessed an instantaneous death.
But there could be, I mean, well, there could be times that that happens.
I mean, yeah.
Because when it comes to this, I think that, you know, I know that one of the concerns and one of my concerns also is that we don't have this benefit that's thinly veiled as really a death benefit, right? I mean, I think the intention of this is that it's a disability benefit and that in such that if there are times of sudden death that this would not be granted, you know, and that's kind of clear in my mind, right? I mean, if there's, you know, a sudden death or has, you know, not even 1 second that they were disabled, you know, this is not a benefit that we would be providing in this case, from my understanding of our legal advice, which obviously it's advice that we can, you know, choose to consider or not. But so I think that, you know, that's one thing when we think about being fiduciaries of the system and thinking about, okay, are we fairly applying the statutes that we have, and are we doing right by our system and right by our members? And that, you know, there might be instances where this isn't just, you know, a rubber stamp and we're signing off on, oh yeah, we know it's really a disability, I mean, it's really a death, but we're just going to call it a disability to give the person extra money. You know, I think that there's going to be cases where that's going to come into play where we're not, you know, we're not actually granting that benefit.
So to that point, I think
we have what we have because of John Mazzetti, because of our concerns about his situation.
Yeah.
If you have an employee who decides to challenge the Darwin rule and says, hey guys, watch this, jumps off a roof while he's working and splats, hits the ground and dies instantly there. Okay. No, he wasn't disabled. He made a decision to do something dangerous and he died instantly because of it. I would say in that situation that this wouldn't apply. But for Mazzetti, I think that's one of the main reasons why.
But what if he did jump off? And I'm going to play devil's advocate. What if he jumped off but lived for 5 minutes before he actually died? I mean, how would you distinguish that? Yes, he made a really stupid decision, but nevertheless, he was disabled for those 5 minutes while an active employee. And that's really your scenario, your hypothetical, sort of brings me back to my concern at our last meeting, is I can't see a circumstance where this would not apply. And people said, well, but what about alcohol, drug abuse? Maybe, but I would argue if I were a surviving spouse, that was a disability. They had an addiction, and that created the disability. So I honestly cannot think of a scenario where this would not apply, unless someone could be proven to die instantly. So that's sort of the challenge. And that's why I'm going back to, and Will, I appreciate you saying, you know, this is about John Mazzetti, if we should be having a lengthy discussion further on if we want to revise how we apply this. But we have it written up as a disability. You know, my initial reaction was, you know, you should have someone who, they get sick, they're not able to work, they're disabled, and then they die as a result of that disability, which is what I think it was originally written. Over the years, we've applied it in a much more liberal standpoint, and I think Harvey said he can justify it to a court. And so I'm still not there. I mean, don't be offended. You got to agree to disagree with me on things. I do it all the time on other boards. You know, don't take it personally. I'm just not there with how this board interprets this provision. So that's where I am.
I've been in the four of a lot of 5-4 votes here, I don't take it personally.
I don't hold it against you guys either. I mean, I see you've got precedents behind you. It's just when I read this and I look at these circumstances, I don't see how this is not a death benefit. I don't see, you could bring me any single person and I could, using this analysis, say they're entitled to it. Right. In every single circumstance. So to me, it is a death benefit, but we're calling it a disability.
So to that point, and I apologize to Rusty and Scott, but just to that point, then fine, let's have a discussion on this. Let's agendize it. Let's all do our research.
I think we should.
And come plan for it. Yeah. But that's not what we're dealing with, Mr. Mazzetti.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've said my piece. Rusty.
Where do I start? I feel like in some ways I've made this personal about Mr. Mazzetti. Granted, he's a former employee, and it's unfortunate how he passed away. And I'm sure we all care about his spouse and her circumstance. But you know, I try to look at these disability cases fairly across, consistently across any type of disability case. Not stretching the imagination or letting my emotions run high to blur my judgment. You know, and again, this is, I'm supporting Candace in this case, that this is a unique circumstance we haven't dealt with before, and I don't want to set a precedence that will justify in the future making the same decision when I'm not sure if it's right. Okay, it needs to be studied and understood better by the board. But to that end, you know, I think we need to, I'm sure it's already established, follow the standards that are set to assess disabilities so that they're objective, within the law, they're consistently handled in a fair, just way, without any bias or emotions, again, blurring our judgment. I have nothing against, again, Mr. Massetti here, and I want to do what's right for him, and more importantly, for his spouse now. But I just can't see what's right now. But the time and the philosophy behind the timing of the death, it's something we haven't dealt with before, and feel like before we make a decision on this, we should make a decision on what the standard should be for disability when somebody has a heart attack and you're not there to witness it. So anyway, those are my two cents. Sorry.
Rusty, just to be clear, we have dealt with this before. We had this exact case of somebody suffering a cardiac event. It was unwitnessed in 2017, and it was a 9-0 vote. Okay. We have 20 years of precedent, and I would ask if the board knows this, how many of these have we denied in the 20-plus? How long have we been offering this, first off, to get that on the record, and how many of these have we denied?
I mean, well, how many of you have you actually faced? Maybe that was the only one back in 2017. I don't know.
It's very rare that we have these.
Well, yeah.
It's very rare that we have them. Maybe the last 10 years. I mean, we have the numbers, but a couple of year kind of thing.
2018, we had three active deaths.
Three. And the board's actions?
They are granted all three.
Oh, but in this case, where again the person died of a heart attack that nobody witnessed, and we don't know how long he suffered before he actually passed.
Did no one witness the gentleman?
No one witnessed in the 2017 case per Todd this morning.
Is that?
That's true. Now, you didn't vote in that case, and I don't know how you interact with your deputies in terms of expressing your vote, but Belinda did vote yes for it.
Right.
And every other voting member of this board, even though, Jerry, you're an alternate in the past, you voted on this, 9-0.
I've never seen, I've been here since, I think, 2013, I've never seen us even discuss this. This is more of a... an acceptance item, if you will, almost. I know it's on the agenda, and it's of course something that we have to approve. But it's from my experience, it's been as simple as certifying a member coming into the system.
We could do this agenda.
That's what the prior practice I've had with this item. It's basically we just push this thing through every single time. I don't know how many I've seen in the last 5 years, but I've never.
To Candace's question, though, then you know. In this situation, will we just pretty much grant every request?
Rusty, I agree with the philosophical question and this being a possible loophole, or you know, but they are definitively, in my opinion, the doctor's opinion that we have before us, we're disabled. Now, in terms of the questioning of time, of how long is somebody disabled with complete destruction of the human body, I mean, we could go into... You know, if you put a bomb in somebody's chest and you set it off, there's still a question of time. You know, that's not what was before us right now. If we want to agendize that, I think that there's kind of this thought that we could look at that in the future. But let's talk about John Mazzetti and the X number of years of precedence that we have of just pushing these through. This is a form that John Mazzetti came to the board, downloaded on the website, or was, you know, asked for. I haven't even filled this form out. A lot of our members haven't filled this form out. So he actually elected to fill out this form and set this option and sign it, put it through, and, you know. So it's not a question of I definitively have seen this before, of an unwitnessed cardiac event in 2017, and I'm sure if we look at the 5 years of cases I've seen, there's going to be other unwitnessed events as well. Right? You know, I don't think the board – staff have that, you know, I don't think that's the question.
So is that standard, though, we're using in this case consistent with all other disability cases?
And what standard? I'm sorry.
The standard of not being able to witness it or the injury or whatever, we just...
I don't know the statistics on the population of cases that have been presented to this board, but my guess is that a number of them have been unwitnessed, including the one case that, Todd, I'm sure you referenced in referencing this case.
What I mean to say, though, not just with death, but with any other disability case where we award them, whether it's service or non-service connected, are we following the same standard, or is this a different, higher standard, or what?
You're talking about death. I think you're talking about, like, is somebody disabled and still alive, right?
Right, yeah.
And they put in for
determination. As far as the weight of evidence, do we lighten up or loosen the rule on the weight of the evidence that has to be shown before you make a decision on whether to award or not?
Well, I don't mean to be blunt, but the evidence that we have before us is he's dead. I mean, you know, the cases that you're talking about.
Is that a disability in this case?
I would consider somebody definitely disabled if they're deceased.
But in terms of
the
way the laws.
Right. And I think we have an opinion from a medical doctor that's seen it was a cardiac related case. We have an opinion before us. Whether or not it's admissible in a court of law, you know, I'm not going to bring that up as a question. But we have this before us, just like we have all the cases that I've ever seen. We have a medical doctor that opinions that the person was disabled before death. That's it. That's from my 5 years experience. These are just essentially almost like acceptance, you know, just regular acceptance items.
Harvey, you wanted to opine on this?
The board has to make judgment calls on disability cases all the time. You make it on permanent incapacity. You make it on job causation. How do you do that? None of you witness the individual. Rusty raises some very, you know, good questions about on what do we base our judgment calls? Because we can't go to the legislature on every single one of these things and have them say 10 seconds is the line or 10 days is the line or something like that. That's why the board exercises its judgment. So what do you base that judgment on in a typical disability case where you're trying to determine permanent incapacity and then you have to evaluate the job and what the job requirements are? And what evidence do you get? Most of the time, you get the doctor's opinion, or more than one doctor, and you might get somebody from the employer, you know, talking about what the job requirements are and that sort of thing, and then you're making a judgment call, can that person fulfill those job duties, or are they incapacitated, and is their incapacity permanent? So you're relying mostly on a doctor. And the question in your mind each and one of those times is it reasonable to rely on the doctor? Do you find what the doctor has said credible? We've had many situations where we've said, you know what, Dr. So-and-so, I won't use any names if one comes to mind, mm-hmm. you know, didn't do a very good job on this. Send it back. We want Dr. So-and-so to look at this again and tell us specifically on incapacity or something like that. So in those situations, the board is making a judgment call that they have medical evidence in front of them, but it's not credible or not sufficiently credible to persuade the board, and so the board wants a little bit more. What do you have in this situation? You do have medical evidence. Like many of your cases, the medical evidence that's submitted to you is not from somebody who's actually seen, touched, or talked to the disability applicant. They're doing it off a review of records. That's the same here as I read it. There was a review of records, there was a review of the death certificate, there's a knowledge in the doctor of what happens, as Dr. McDonald and Member Pigeon has said, this is in our experience, this is what happens in a heart attack situation. So you can take that into account, too. You can take into account the observations and experience of members of the board. So you have before you the doctor's statement that in the doctor's opinion, based on what he has observed, that this member was alive but incapacitated for a period of time before death. Now, you can find that credible or not credible. But you're going to make the same kind of judgment call in this situation as you make in every disability case. You're just going to weigh that evidence. You're going to weigh your own experience and your own common sense. And you're going to make a collective judgment. That collective judgment may be 5-4. But that's the way this board works. Majority rule. So you're not always going to be unanimous on these things from an evidentiary standpoint. But that, you know, I'm trying to address your question, Rusty, about are we loosening up the standard of what is persuasive to us in terms of evidence to support our decision? I think you're not. You're still going to look at the evidence that you have, circumstantial, eyewitness, or whatever you're given, and on the basis of that, you're going to make a judgment call. That's all you can do.
So one other thing, just for those of the members that are kind of on the fence on this whole thing, I appreciate, again, I keep reiterating this. I appreciate the kind of question philosophically, but in this case, for this item, John Mozzetti, per code of fiduciary conduct and ethics, ours, in those situations where the law is not clear, the best interests of the fund beneficiaries must be served. Yeah. So if you're sitting and teetering on the fence, please, for this case, just fall to our code of ethics that we've all agreed to.
Thank you. Rusty, are you done with your comments?
I am.
Okay, Scott.
So, I think we've belabored this probably more than we need to, but just a couple of points. In terms of the decision if a member is disabled, it's a decision that we make. The statute says that we make it. The statute doesn't have a presumption that says if someone dies of a heart attack, they're presumed to have been disabled before they died. The legislature didn't have the infinite wisdom to make this a little easier for us in these kinds of cases. I may have voted differently on the prior case. I'm looking at this one because of the facts as they come before us. I look at each one of these on a case-by-case basis. Every disability we hear, every application we hear, we read everything, or we should. And this case brought into focus the points that Candace made earlier, which is that it's hard to conjure a situation where the benefit wouldn't apply. What I want to speak to, though, is that don't confuse ethics and fiduciary responsibilities or question the ethics of board members because we differ in our opinions. Reasonable minds can differ on this. I read everything. I went to our website. I thoroughly digested what we post to members, read the statute, read the cases, read everything, thought a lot about this. So to me, the best interest of the members often is protecting the fund for the benefit of the members, because if we invade the corpus inappropriately enough times and on enough bases, there won't be benefits to pay to members. So the best interest of the members sometimes is protecting the FISC. We have to take all that into account. And I just think that it's not about always making a decision in favor of a member, because the member's interest is that they receive the benefit to which they're entitled. And I know the point was made that this benefit was opted for and applied for by the member, but that's only part of the question. We still get to make the determination amongst whether or not somebody's disabled.
And it's funded, though.
And it's I'm not convinced it's funded. There's no actuarial evidence in front of us that says it is. I've heard a lot of anecdotal discussion about it, but there's really nothing in front of us that says it is or isn't. So I'm not going to base my decision on that ground alone. I'm just saying it's still an open question. But the idea is that I feel like in this case there's just been at times a torturing of the English language to try to get to a result, and I'm just bristling at that because it's just a circumstance where unfortunately in this case someone is found deceased. There are no eyewitnesses. There's no understanding. There is discussion and expert opinion, if you will, about causation and what happens in a heart attack versus something else. But there's just no specific evidence. And the statute doesn't say in close calls you must do X, or the presumption is Y. It just doesn't say that. So we're left to flounder. And frankly, this is a policy that we could opt out of. Am I correct? This is not a benefit we have to offer.
This is an interpretation of the benefit that's in the law.
Right. Correct.
You could change your mind, and that would be subject to challenge.
Okay. So, in any event, I just think reasonable minds can differ. We've heard a lot of that disparity here on this issue. And I think to the point about Mr. Mozzetti, and the reason I said last time and today that I respected the family and that we're discussing this case as a consequence of his passing. But the reality is, this is how issues come before us. Someone's disabled at work, we get a disability case. Someone dies, and the surviving spouse comes before us. This is how these policy discussions are teed up. It's unfortunate that it's appended to a pending application, but it is what it is. Mm-hmm. So I just take it. I take it case by case, and this one's a hard call.
Yeah. Oh, it's definitely a hard call. And, you know, I just, This is like the member followed, from my understanding, followed everything, essentially textbook, that we've asked. And we have precedent of 20 years of doing this. I'm just using 20 years as a number. The staff haven't presented to me how long we've been doing this. It's been a significant amount of time. Now, retirement applications become before us as well. So should we start, you know, questioning those as well? I mean, that they go through all the normal steps. They have 20 years. We have, you know, how long this system has been enacted. And we don't have to grant retirement applications. I bet you this board could say no to a retirement application as well. My point is that we have precedent. I don't want to make it a John Mazzetti case. I don't want to do that. If you want to give this staff direction after this case and say, yes, we should look at this as possibly adjusting this, that should be a separate action. And I totally support having that discussion lengthy. But we have case after case after case, including cases in 2017. This exact case, other than where they were found in 2017, Scott, I would guess, I didn't look at the vote, but I guess you'd vote. You voted unanimously to support that as well.
I may have.
Yeah, and I appreciate the differing in opinion, mm-hmm. I think everyone knows my case. It's just we just have too much history here of, and everything's been presented before us, just like all the other ones. And here we just, you know, off a whim for this individual, we say no.
But it's not that way.
No, but it is.
No, because this one's different from all the others except for the one in 2017. No. All the others, there was evidence before they were disabled or when they were disabled, and we can measure that. We can see that.
Measurable.
And I'm not against the disability benefit, not at all. And I would agree with all the others, but this one's unique except for the 2017, which, you know, I'm sorry, I missed out on that. But you made the point earlier about setting a precedence. And if we go ahead and prove it today, then we get two cases where in the future, if we decide differently as a board not to allow it anymore, people are going to point back to these two cases and argue why. So I'm trying to be careful and be consistent and decide as a board whether or not, again, in this circumstance, in this unique case, is this the way we want to rule it? If we want to allow for disability or not, is it the right way?
Yeah, I don't think it's unique. I don't think it's unique. And if you want to be consistent, I think we should vote in favor of.
How is it not unique?
Because this is 2017. We had the exact same case. And we're speculating right now on the other cases that we don't have presented as evidence before us in terms of the statistics before us.
There was measurable time. And that's the point that Harvey made in his memo here.
Yeah.
And as a board, what is the standard? What's measurable? Is it just a few seconds or minutes? And is it all based on what a doctor says? Is that enough? And if it is, if the board decides, great, then we have something we can go by. But we don't have anything really except for this one case in 2017 mm-hmm. to go by and make a fair judgment.
Real quick on point in time, to Scott's point as well, CERL gives us the ability to determine who's disabled. There's nothing in CERL that determines what time limit somebody is disabled.
Okay. So for me to vote, I'm going to be consistent, and it'd be helpful if we had standard. Told me in this circumstance, this is how we do it. And we don't, except this.
But we don't know how many before 2017 that had heart attacks that weren't witnessed. We don't know that. And got the 2017 case. What other ones are out there that we weren't told about?
What was the date of the 17 case?
So it was September 13th, 2017. Okay. And I cite that as, and granted, it's anecdotal because he was a Central San member, and so I'm familiar with it, and I remember it well because it was, you know, in our family. So I would be careful to, if I were, I wouldn't make the statement this was the only one. I'm
one-sided. Okay.
Well, the only one-sided. That's fair. Right. I think that's a better characterization of it. So, John. Oh wait, I'm sorry. Harvey, then John, then David.
Just to be very clear. In disability applications, the member has the burden of proving by preponderance of the evidence before the board that they were permanently incapacitated. So you're going to weigh the evidence that you have before you and determine whether the member carried their burden of proof. That's
and I thought of that early, but I thought, in all fairness to Mr. Mazzetti, he didn't have a chance to show the proof. I mean, except his body.
Just, and that's why we file it on his behalf. I mean, that's what this is all about. Right. We're acting on the member's behalf.
So John was waiting. Can I put you in line, Jerry?
I'm persuaded first by Harvey's tie goes to the member, and this has been a very helpful process to me in enforcing that. Every instinct in me is going to be the opposite of that. The however is, we are put in an impossible, from my point of view, circumstance where the answer, we have to decide what is instantaneous versus what is 2 milliseconds. That just isn't a possible answer. So where I come down is that what we are really doing is offering a death benefit that will go to everybody in a similar circumstance under the current set of rules. I intend to vote yes on the motion on this, but absolutely support our coming up with some kind of a policy structure that we can look to in the future, we can make our employees aware of, we can make a part of our compensation structure, which now we don't. Right now we describe the benefit as a disability benefit, as contrasted to a death benefit, and it's a death benefit. So we come up with some kind of an answer that in the future gives us some guidance on how you make these impossible decisions. Anyway, that's what I wanted to get across.
Thank you, John. David, you were next.
Yeah, so Scott, I mean, you feel uncomfortable because you don't have definitive evidence regarding that time of disability or degree of disability. And isn't it true that we just have to rely on the best evidence available and in making our decision? And there's no way we can go back. We can't get, there was no forensic investigation done. There was no autopsy done, as far as I understand. And given our medical advisor, and because of experience from some of the members here on the board and so forth, don't we really need to give our member the benefit of the doubt in this situation? And so it's yes on that.
I think that's exactly what John just said.
Okay.
Well,
John, you just went. Jerry, then Candace.
Okay. Jerry, you haven't had an opportunity to speak. I don't know if you want to speak on the issue I'm thinking about, okay. And I'm going to call for the question.
Candace wanted to say something.
A point of the Paul Crouch.
So point of order, there's been a call for the question. Is there an objection to the call?
I objected. I think Candace should have the opportunity.
Okay, then we'll have a vote on whether to uphold the objection. Is that
general? I would be very sure.
No, you need to vote on the call for the question.
No, that's what I'm saying. But is the affirmative?
I'll tell you what. I release my call for the question until Candace has her opportunity.
Candace and Jerry.
Okay, all I want to point out, because a lot of discussion has been made for the September 13th, 2017, what we had before us that day was a one-page piece of paper that did not talk about time of death. It did not talk about that he died of a heart attack while he was on vacation, that death was instantaneous. All it stated was that the medical records were analyzed by the board's medical advisor, who concluded that evidence showed he was totally disabled from employment at the time of his death. So we did not have any of the facts and circumstances that we have today before us. Had that, not to say there would have been a different outcome, but I just want to put that on the record, that today's, however people are voting, is not necessarily inconsistent with 2017, because the information we had before us was very limited and did not go into that detail that death was, that he was discovered dead. So
she's right. And to that point, did you have the information regarding Mr. Crouch's death, the circumstances and nature with you? Is your best recollection, when you prepare for these things, you prepare and you're ready to discuss them with the board?
We're prepared to discuss them. In the case of Mr. Crouch, the information on the medical information was not provided to us. Mm-hmm. The situation was verbally communicated to us by outside of Sosera that he was on vacation.
Okay. And that, it's neither here nor there. I'm just,
no, it's helpful.
It's just helpful, because I would hate to see my votes being inconsistent, where one time I would say, oh, he died instantly and we had no record that he had a disability prior, but here I did. So that's just...
Thank you.
Jerry.
I call for the question.
Jerry, can you just hold it?
Jerry had.
I'm sorry. When you said Jerry, I was sorry. This way, I didn't know you meant that
I'm
Jerry
so
over there.
This has been a big issue. Go ahead, Jerry.
I'll try and be brief, but it's difficult for me. At the last meeting, I think there was a hope, at least on my part, that we would be able to come back and discuss this in greater detail. And it's unfortunate that it's attached to a specific individual, and I would certainly echo the concern everyone else has about the fact that this is, we're talking about a real person who's no longer here and whose family is still in some state of grief, and so I am sympathetic to that. So that's unfortunate, but Scott makes an excellent point. That's how so many of our conversations end up being brought up. Mm-hmm. They end up starting on a specific case of some sort. We hardly ever bring up, I shouldn't say hardly ever, we don't often bring up subjects out of nowhere. They tend to be a product of some other discussion that sometimes is related to an individual case. This has been useful for me. I am concerned about other cases that have been brought up that could, in fact, be held up as precedents, because I think that would be discussed in a court of law if that's what ends up being. I have no problem whatsoever and would support the idea of having a more fulsome, if that's possible, discussion in the future about this policy in general without being attached to this. I guess I want to make sure I want to go on record too is that I used to have a saying that I had when salesmen came in and talked to me that be careful you don't go past the point of sale. You know, once you've already made really good arguments, don't end up with an argument that says, and in addition, you're going to be unethical if you vote the wrong way on this. I didn't appreciate hearing that from the chief with that sweeping generalization, and I have similar concerns about having it mentioned here. I think other arguments that have been effective were effective without necessarily impugning the motives of board members. So I don't think that's necessary. So I intend to speak in favor of the motion relating specifically to Mr. Mazzetti.
Thank you, Jerry. Harvey?
With regard to the choices before the board, you do have an option if the board believes that you need to try to obtain further evidence than this one doctor. You could send this to a hearing officer and get more evidence and present it back. I don't know what kind of evidence that might be, but that is an option to you in making your consideration as well.
Thank you.
Did you call for the question?
any objections to the call? Hearing none, the motion is parts one and two of the recommendation in the item 10 memoranda. We'll do a roll call vote. Anderson?
No.
Gordon?
No.
Holcomb?
Yes.
McDonald?
Aye.
Phillips?
Yes.
Pigeon?
Yes.
Smithy? Yes. Tullis?
Yes.
Watts?
No.
Okay, the motion passes. Okay. Thank you.
And we are going to agendize this down the road. Down the road.
I think it would be helpful to have that discussion.
I think we should go into it. But not with the case at hand. Go into it.
No, we're not going to revisit the case. I assure you.